we were doing these anti-nuclear campaigns to try and stop nuclear testing. But there were a few of us within the group who felt that we needed this environmental revolution, and we decided the first campaign we were going to do was we were going to stop the slaughter of the great whales. Now, at this time, the marine mammals in the world, the seals, the whales, almost all marine mammals in the world, on average, were about 5 to 10% of their peak herds. In other words, humanity had wiped out 95% of the marine mammals by the time we did these campaigns. And we were still considered nutcases. We were mocked. We were ridiculed for doing what we were doing, as if it was a silly. I mean, even some people in the social movements thought it was silly to go out and save animals. But what we were trying to do was not just save the whales. We were trying to save the whales. We were trying to save the last of the whales because they were beautiful. But we also felt that the whales represented nature. They represented the beauty and the elegance and the magnificence of nature, and that if people could relate to whales, well, perhaps they could relate to the rest of nature. And we thought this is surely going to begin the ecological revolution. This is a photograph I took at that time. My friend Paul Spong, who was a cetacean scientist, came over with this big cardboard box to my house, said, "Rex, you got to take a picture." I said, "Sure, okay." He dumps these brains out on my kitchen table. My wife was slightly horrified, but he said, "You got to take this picture because when people see this picture, they're going to realize, you know, these whales are not only beautiful animals, they're intelligent animals." Now, we know that the size of the brain is not necessarily directly proportional to intelligence, but this brain that you're looking at did not evolve for no reason at all, and this is mostly cerebral cortex that you're looking at. The animal size of the brain, of the whale's brain, is about the same size as yours and mine or a rhesus monkey. So this is all cerebral cortex that you're looking at. So this cerebral cortex did not evolve for no reason at all. And of course we know that whales have very sophisticated communication and so forth. But taking this photograph was another transformative experience for me, because when I looked at these brains, I thought, oh my goodness gracious, this is you know, we think, is there intelligent life on other planets? Well, here's a news flash. There's intelligent life on this planet. We're not the only intelligent species, and that's an important thing to understand, too. And it's also important to understand that there's lots of different kinds of intelligence. There's my buddy Bob Hunter, who just passed away a few years ago. This is us out in the middle of the Pacific looking for the whalers. Now, we had this little radio directional finder that one of our engineers had actually built on the boat. So we were able to listen for Russian voices and then like try and find out where they were, because we could sort of get a directional fix on them. But there was this old notion of whaling as if it was brave little men in these little boats and these vicious leviathans that they were hunting. Here's the reality of it. And our mission, part of our mission in these early campaigns, was to show this reality, that it wasn't this old, that wasn't what whaling was about. This is what whaling was about. It was about industrial civilization scooping up the last remnants of the marine mammals on the planet. This is the Russian factory ship. I mean, it's a floating factory processing these whales with the harpoon boat on the side there. This is us with our little sign that says Nyet, and it has a dead whale on it. These are the Russian sailors. The Russian sailors were actually quite interesting. They were really funny, and they kept wanting to talk to us and getting us closer. And we got up to, right up to the back of the first time we approached one of the whaling boats, we got right up to the back of this harpoon boat, and these whalers were waving us over, and we got over there, and we were giving them Greenpeace pins, and they were actually taking their little service pins off and giving them to us. It was a fantastic moment. But this one, they wave us over, and this one guy, the first thing they ever said to us was, "Do you have any LSD? Oh my God, we forgot, you know. We went back to the boat and brought them some rum. That was the best we could do, which they were grateful for. So we blockaded the whaling ships, and we We thought this was successful. I mean, it was successful in a sense, is that we eventually won a moratorium on the deep sea whaling. And we managed to win a moratorium on ocean dumping. And we won, we've won some victories in forestry around the world and so forth. I mean, we have had, Greenpeace has had a huge effect. I don't work for Greenpeace anymore, except I write a column for their website. But Greenpeace has had a huge effect. And I think in one sense, we did sort of help push the environmental movement along. This is flash forward 20 years, 30 years. This is the home of the Warani and the Wichí indigenous people in Brazil and Argentina. This is their home. They live here. They're sustainable. If you want real sustainability, now, by our standards, these are poor people, but they're sustainable. All they need is a forest. They're fine. They can live in the forest. That this is what's happening. 24 hours a day, I'm not kidding you, dawn to dusk. These bulldozers are ripping up the forest, and this is what's left. And they're doing this to create soybean farms, soybeans to feed the pigs, and they're not even using the forest products. They're burning the forest because it's faster. It's more economical, so-called. This is a Warani woman, Noemi Cruz, and she sort of was our guide there and took us around. And they designed this whole little thing. They wanted us to be jaguars, they said, so they designed these T-shirts for us. And because this was their sacred animal, the jaguars, and this was, of course, the home of the jaguars. Of course, there's no more jaguars in this forest. But this is what's being done to the forest, 24 hours a day. We're losing about, some of you may have the latest data better than I do, but I think about 14 million hectares a year of forest net loss. We're halfway through the world's forest. Peak forest, we're about 8 billion hectares. Forest now on the planet is about less than 4, so we're more than halfway through the global forests. And we're cutting through it at about 14 million hectares a year. So and for these people, this was very serious. They did this ceremony with us. They inducted us into their tribe. They designed these jaguar costumes for us. And we took off on these motorcycles basically to stop the bulldozers. And we did. We managed to stop the bulldozers. We got so much media in Argentina. It was phenomenal. I mean, every newspaper, every TV station was there. It was an amazing... the whole campaign went on for a couple of years, but at the height of it there, we spent about 2 months stopping bulldozers and getting all this media attention. And we actually managed to save... About 4,000 hectares of land. And this is the president of Argentina, Kirchner, with the head man of the Wichí Indians actually sitting in the president's seat, and he actually gave them the deed to their land and managed to save this little 4,000 hectare piece. But Argentina alone is losing 1 million hectares a year of forest. So this little 4,000 hectare piece was... And look at how, I mean, it took a two-year campaign to save the 4,000 hectares. This is the Brazilian Mato Grosso. You can see what happened between 92 and 08, 16 years. The gray area is the logged area, soybean farms. And that's what's left of it. To feed pigs, to feed bacon to these people. That's what's going on. And of course, as they grow soybeans on these soils, the soils dissipate, and they might get 10 or 12 years out of the soils, and then the soils are gone. Now here, because of cutting down the forest and because of the fossil fuels we're burning, this is what we've done. We've put this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. I know we saw some of this earlier. I think Dr. Waddington showed us some of this stuff earlier. But here's the thing that I want to point out. James Lovelock in the 1960s was pointing out that we were increasing the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Greenpeace had this curve from James Lovelock, sent it to us. I remember on the wall in the Greenpeace Chronicles office, we had the curve showing exponential growth of carbon dioxide. We tried to do stories about carbon dioxide in the 1970s, and no one would even talk to us. So the Kyoto Protocol, this is going to solve it, right? There it was. First draft was in 92. It was adopted in 98. And here we are today. Zero net effect. There's the science. There's the public activism. There's the resolution. There's the whole international community flying around to Rio and Kyoto and Johannesburg. For how much effect? Zero net effect. This is why I say we need a paradigm shift of major proportions. Because everything we've done, all the Greenpeace campaigns, Friends of the Earth, Sierra Club, you, me, everything we've done is not even remotely enough. And I think a part of that is because we're starting from the wrong direction. We're starting from where we are and trying to quibble our way back with Priuses and so-called green products. And now there are many good green products, by the way, don't get me wrong here, and there's many good engineering and innovation ideas, but I don't think we're going to get there that way. Here's a bunch of curves for you. These are all exponential curves, more or less. Population, GDP, the number of rivers dammed. All of these graphs are between 1750 and 2000. One of the most interesting ones is the paper. You see in the middle of the third row there, paper consumption. Remember when computers were, you know, this is another one of those innovation promises. Remember when computers were going to save paper? Can you see on that graph where the paper was saved? Since the 1950s, we've gone from 50 million tons a year to 250 million tons a year. Computers used more paper, correct? So let's don't delude ourselves. Now, if you aggregate all of this stuff, and I think this is sort of an important thing we have to look at. We have to look. Peak water, peak paper, peak everything. Soil, phosphorus, coal, oil, all the liquid fuels, copper, cement, species loss, fisheries, vehicles, all of this stuff on an exponential curve. So if you aggregate that, you get roughly this. Something like this. So if you look at the doubling times and figure out what this growth curve looks like, it looks like that. It's about 3.5% growth. It's somewhere between 3 and 4% growth per year in the destruction of the planet, in the throughput of stuff. Now, if you take the 1750 throughput and call that one unit of throughput, then by 1950, 200 years later, at 3.5% growth, that would be a 20-year doubling time. Do you guys all know how to convert percentage growth to doubling times? Divide it into 70, divide the percentage growth. This is a good thing to know, a little good rule of thumb. If you're not a mathematician, it's easy enough. Divide the percentage growth. So when someone says that your community is growing by 2%, you can just in your head go, okay, 70 divided by 2 is 35. That means we're going to double in 35 years. So if we're growing our throughput at 3.5%, then we're going to double the stuff we use every 20 years. So in 200 years, that's 10 doublings, and 10 doublings is 1,024. We call it 1,000. So by 1950, we were using 1,000 times more stuff. This is sort of the aggregate throughput of the human civilization. 1,000 times more stuff by 1950 than we were using in 1750. But here's the thing about doubling times. So there's our 1950 throughput, 1,000 times more stuff. Now here's the problem, and I don't mean to simplify this because I know that there are economists today who understand biophysical economics and understand that economics is much more complex than this. But this is the simple model of human economics that we have operated on for a long time, which is that we have production and we have consumption, and that production is able to pay wages to the households are able to buy the stuff, and that these economies can grow. So this size economy can become this size economy. But we all know what we've forgotten to think about. When we build these economies, we're building them on something and in something. We're not just on the earth, we're inside a living biosphere. We're inside the experiment that we're trying to understand, which is a very complex scientific situation to be in, to be inside the experiment that we're trying to understand, and on the other hand, to be the biggest variable within that experiment. So here's a better look at economics, is that to have a human economy, you have to have resource inputs and you have to have waste sinks to toss the stuff away. And when the economy grows from here to here, the resource inputs grow and the waste sinks grow, and we have not accounted for that. We have considered the resources to be free and the waste sinks to be irrelevant, to be externalities. Here's a better drawing, and this comes from Herman Daly. Those of you who haven't read the book, by the way, Steady State Economics, this is a classic. That this book was first written in the 70s, published, I believe, in the late 70s, and it is still absolutely classic, important information, which we still haven't caught up with. We'll get to more of that later. But here's a system sort of after Daly. I've added the regenerative universe that's kicking out energy and matter all the time. There's a good book, if you read Lee Smolin's book called, I think, Life of the Cosmos. He talks about how he sort of does for the cosmos that what John Lovelock did with the Gaia book about the Earth, that it's a living system. It's kicking out energy and matter, the stuff we live on. So in fact, the human economy has this massive throughput of matter and energy, and we can recycle some of the matter. Some of the material we're recycling. Nature recycles all the rest. But energy is not recyclable. This is the second law of thermodynamics. This is the law of entropy. Energy, once we use it, it's gone. And it dissipates out as heat. This is the throughput, and this is what we have not accounted for in our systems. This massive throughput of stuff, which grew from 1 to 1,000 by 1950, and then by 1970, 20 years later, it doubled again. So now we're using 2,000 times as much stuff as we were using in 1750. Now let's talk about this area under the curve, because this is really important. This is the stuff. And the important thing to understand about the area under the curve is that between 1950 and 1970, the stuff we used in those 20 years is greater than all the stuff used between 1750 and 1950. You can just eyeball it and you can see that's the case. If you actually do the calculus, you'll find that the area under that curve in the last 20 years is greater than the area under the earlier portion of the curve. And in fact, that goes all the way back to forever, because it dwindles off to such a significantly small number before 1750. So we use more stuff in the 20 years between 1950 and 1970 than we had used ever before. Now here's the thing, then we did it again. In another 20 years, we doubled our throughput again, 4,000 times what we used in 1750. Now the area under that curve is equal not only to all the stuff before, including the previous 20 years. All this stuff that humans used between 1970 and 1990 is greater than all the stuff used between 1750 and 1950. So when you look at the exponential growth of our environmental problems and our environmental challenges, and you wonder why are we learning about all of these things about global warming now and about the sea level increase and all these things, it just seems so dramatic and so fast. Well, it's because it is. But we were warned. This is Malthus, 1800s, Thomas Malthus. This is what he was talking about. And Malthus was mocked, and he was ridiculed, and he is still ridiculed, but he was dead right. The one thing that Malthus, I think, was wrong about was that the effects aren't immediate, and that we can drag it out. And that, yes, the innovations in the discovery of oil have allowed us to drag out this consumption and use of the planet, but we are now coming up against the limits that he was talking about. This is Alice Hamilton. She was talking about lead poisoning from lead in gasoline before it was ever on the market. She told the people at General Motors, she says, if you put lead in gasoline, you will kill people. And she called it random murder, and that's exactly what it was. And they knew in the 20s and 30s, they knew that the lead in gasoline would kill people. And it took 50 years until 1970 for the United States and Canada to ban lead in gasoline. 50 years. So This is one problem. I'm very doubtful sometimes that the corporations, the companies, are going to lead the change. I don't think so. I think you and I are going to lead the change.